You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
What I am here to talk about is something that captured my attention, and I can tell you the moment when my interest in this topic started. And it was a moment that we all have those moments that you can look back and you can remember the sights, you can remember the sounds, you can remember how you felt. And that moment was in Ephrata Community Hospital. And it was a moment that my wife and I were called to go and say goodbye to my grandpa. His name was Gerald Ellison, and he was my hero. He is my hero. I drink out of a coffee mug every day that says his name, Gerald. That was his mug on that. He was a pastor who understood the transformative power of the gospel and lived it out. And his wife, Margretta and Gerald, these were my grandparents, and they just had this spunk, they had this love, and it was that time when the doctors knew that this was the end of life. And so we showed up, and it wasn't just us, it was other family members, and had some really special moments, and then they turned off the machine, and you watched the life go from him. That moment is seared in my memory, but what is also seared in is what happened next. My grandmother is the most regal woman that I have ever known. She is proper, she is had family in England, and she just epitomized like royalty to me. But in that moment, as my grandfather walked from this life into the next, my regal grandmother threw her body on her husband and said, "Gerald, don't leave me." And she wept as she said goodbye to her best friend. And that moment to me, that seared, because that was a love that lasted to the very end. I don't think I have ever seen a picture quite like that of two individuals that did life so well together, honoring, loving, cherishing each other. In that moment, I got a picture of a life well lived. The reason that stands out also is because shortly before this moment, I was going on a trip. Hope International was growing rapidly. And I was leaving for Peru. And my wife, we'd been married about a decade at that point. My wife, at that moment, after the kids were in bed, said, "Peter, let's have a conversation." Anyone know like what that means when you have that sort of a comment? Kids were in bed, sat down on the couch, and she said this. She said, "I love you, but..." Now, the first part of that I was super excited to hear, right? That's always a good part. "I love you, but..." She went on to say, There was a distance that was growing in our relationship. She said, "But I feel nothing for you anymore." Said, "I am committed to you. I'm committed to making this work. But I feel nothing for you." And I had this stark picture in this very short period of time that what my grandfather in his life and his love, the way that he finished well, and the path that I was on at that moment, that did not leave to the same destination. That moment was a wake-up moment for me that transformed our marriage, transformed my life. Because up until that point, I would say that we were going along, and it's like one of those cartoons with a car that's accelerating really, really fast. And then you don't realize, though, that the earth had, you're off a cliff, and the earth is no longer underneath you. And in that moment, that was the image of being all of this. And the great irony as we're doing this is I was doing so much amazing work, if I do humbly say so myself, for God around the world, and yet I had lost sight on the enormous privilege of loving and honoring and cherishing the people that were closest to me. I was not on a path that led to that beautiful well done at the end. And the other great kind of piece in that was I figured, I'm going to make this right. So I ended up canceling the trip to Peru. Good idea, bad idea. Good idea. ended up taking Laurel away, just the two of us, to a place that she loves the beach, and we went to the beach. Good idea or bad idea? Good idea. Ended up getting all of the emails that we wrote when I was living in Rwanda and she was in Washington, D.C. I thought we would read some of those emails. I'm trying. Got some of her favorite gifts on that. And I couldn't wait to see at the end of the weekend that everything was back to normal. Okay, you're a wise man right there. You know. You could have saved me a lot of time and money, actually, if you had told me that ahead of time. But I can tell you the moment that it did change. It did change when I got my head on straight for the first time in my life and realized that it's possible to have a ministry that can become your mistress. I got my head on straight to say there's a ton of other people that could do the job of Hope International. There is one person that can be the husband to Laurel and dad to Keith, Lily, Miles, and London. And I wrote my letter of resignation, and I put it in an envelope, and I said, Laurel, if you ever feel like this again, send this letter. I will walk away from this job because I choose you, and it's just not a competition. That moment worked. She did mail the letter twice, but I put the wrong address on it the first two times on that. But just kidding. But it was this moment to say, what am I doing? And part of the great irony is, while this is happening at an individual level, I was working on a book called Mission Drift, and it's all how organizations lose their way and lose sight of what is most important. They lose sight of their core mission, and yet I had failed to see in the mirror was a reflection that it's possible to do those same principles in real life. And we started doing case studies about how, did you know, by the way, pawn shops were created by the church as a Christian outreach to serve the poor. They lost their way. Did you know that Harvard University had the founding mission statement to it was really awesome on that. I forgot it too on that. But to consider well that the main end of your life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ. That is the founding mission statement. And they lost their way. And we were doing all of these case studies. And yet I failed to realize that there is a very personal application to this. So maybe you could call this talk Mission Drift, the personal edition. How do we keep sight of what matters most in light of eternity? How do we keep sight of what matters most? The reality is there is a well-worn path that leads away from faithfulness. And if we look at history, if we look at our friendships, if we look around us, we will see that there is a well-worn path. And yet too often we neglect that to our own hurt and harm. And not just our own hurt and harm, but to the hurt and harm of those that are closest to us. This is a well-worn path. And it's almost cliched. What is the time of life that most often we associate with making reasonable people making unreasonable decisions? What time of life is that? Midlife. And did you know that there's actually some empirical data that shows that? I found this really fascinating, but they talk about the U-curve of happiness. And this is done by a number of different ones, but the U-curve of happiness looks at this. It looks at life satisfaction, and it looks at different ages. And guess where it is? Studies vary, but it is between age 45 and 48 that typically is the bottom of that U-curve. Do we have any people here ages 45 to 48? We're going to have a prayer time. Just come on up on that. I see you right there. But it's something. And it's almost cliche, though, right? What's the image of what happens in this time of life? It's this guy, right? It's the one who suddenly loses buttons, right? And suddenly gets the sport car and suddenly just is trying too hard. Now, this is a cliche, but the reality is this time of life requires adjustment. It requires change. And it's not just for men, by the way. That study that I just showed you, how do you think the curve looks for women? That was the men. What do you think the curve looks like for women? The same, with a little bit more happiness on that. So a little bit more life satisfaction on that as well. But the question is, for those of you that are on this side, this is really to prepare you. It's going to get worse on that. But also, the fascinating thing is when you look at this, it's a U-curve. What is it that people eventually figure out? Like, what is it that people are forced to confront that leads to a different time? And then what can we learn from those people that have navigated it really well? As we started to look at this topic, we found that this issue is also based throughout history. This idea of midlife being a disconcerting time or a confusing time was actually written about by Dante in the Divine Comedy. But he says this, midway this way of life were bound upon, I woke to find myself in a dark wood where the right road was wholly lost and gone. Dante had trouble figuring out the middle section of life. And not just him, but it's like, what is going on at this time? What is it about this period of life that for many is disorienting and requires a new perspective? So here we go. Turn to your neighbor. I want your top three. What is it about this stage of life that is particularly causing individuals to lose sight, to feel like they've lost their sense of balance? Turn to your neighbor. Top three. What do you think it is? All right. I need someone over here. What's your top three? And we're giving books away tonight. Amy has books at the table for anyone that responds tonight to any question or any comment whatsoever that I make. Someone from over here. What's your top three? Yeah, real loud.
Empty nest, body,
and career. Empty nest, body, and career. Yes. Thank you. Awesome. Thank you, thank you. Someone from this section.
More responsibility, less freedoms.
More responsibility, less freedoms. Yeah, thank you. Yes. This section. Let's go on here. Yes. You're still right. Yes. Yeah. Fear your death drawing near. You get two books for rhyming on that. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Over here. Yeah. Forgetfulness. Amnesia. Good. Yep. That's excellent. Well done. Well done. Yes. Yes. Excellent. And last, bring us home over here. Yes, all right. Everyone gets a book except this individual here on that. So there's all kinds of them. You're exactly right. And again, the crazy thing is when we take a step back, it just makes sense, right? It makes sense that this is a turbulent time. There is a lot of significant change. And for some, you realize for the very first time, there's more life in the rear view than there is in front. You look at the changes to the body on that. And there are real changes that are happening as well. You look at the graphs and you look at the spike that does seem to coincide with kids. Kids are part of the midlife challenges. And all of this empirical data. But I think another piece is at this point, there is a work calling. The questions of work, is it really working? I've been working so hard, but why am I still not there? Or for some people, they've achieved there and it didn't quite do what they thought. The thrills don't last as long as they thought. That first deal, man, that felt good. The 100th doesn't quite do it in the same way. And for some, there's an element of our rose-colored glasses have been a little bit tainted by our reality. That in some ways, what we thought life was going to be like didn't actually come to pass. And again, this is not saying we didn't achieve our goals. The great irony is this is true for those that achieve and exceed their goals, and it doesn't quite do what they think. Fascinating. If you watch the interview with Tom Brady after his 7th Super Bowl win, just thought I'd bring that up for all of you, just with the New England Patriots, just as an example. But even when he won it, he was like, there's got to be more than this in an interview with ABC News on that. It's fascinating. But at that time, our expectation and reality collide. Our expectation of what we thought life was going to be like, what we thought our career, what we thought our family, what we thought our life was going to be like, for almost everyone, there is a mismatch between expectation and reality. And we know the problems with expectation and reality mismatch, don't we? Where do we look? Pinterest. We look at Pinterest because Pinterest shows us that our expectation of what it is going to be like and then what it actually looks like are not quite the same on that. But we try again. We try with our beautiful kids on a beautiful fall. Let me put my child in the pumpkin on that. You know, I was at a restaurant recently and I saw this, the messy burger. Look at that thing. Look at how amazing that is. This was my reality. I mean, it just did not look the same. And our kids, we just try it. We try to find the way for our expectation and reality. And I have to say, like, book writing has been super fun. But I have to say, my expectation of everyone reading the book and then writing nice reviews on Amazon, my expectation and reality came to a challenge when I woke up on Christmas morning. It was December 25th. Who posts a review on Christmas morning? Who does that? The Grinch. It's got to be the Grinch. That's the only reason. But after Mission Drift went out, this was it. 1 star. Barely informative and almost useless was his review of Mission Drift. What I really found troubling is that 4 people found this helpful on that. So for all of us, we've had enough life. We've had enough reps that our expectation and our reality are mismatched. Those two things are mismatched. And again, the challenge with that causes reasonable people to make unreasonable decisions. This is not a new topic. And the great irony is we can look in the pages of Scripture and we can find case study after case study of where this is lived out. There's an individual did a study on this, and he did a study. His name is Robert Clinton, and he did a study about biblical leaders, and what he found is that only 1 out of 3 biblical leaders maintain a dynamic faith that enables them to avoid abusing their power or doing something harmful to themselves and others. 1 out of 3. 1 out of 3. And his estimate is that today it's similar. 1 out of 3 leaders actually have a dynamic and vibrant faith, and I read that, and I look around at my peer group, and I say, God, help us to do better than that. Help us to do better. And I think part of doing better is actually knowing that this is a time of turbulence. So let's get ready. And if you're on the other side and you've made it through, what are you doing to help people through this period of transition? What are you doing to actively walk with individuals through this time? And I think for all of us to say, let's commit. Like, let's love each other. Let's love our witness to the world so much that we're willing to help each other get through this time. And so how do we do that? How do we make the statement not true? Long-term faithfulness is rare. How do we change that and say, long-term faithfulness is our story? And wouldn't it be amazing if there are more individuals at that moment saying goodbye to their spouse with their family surrounded and every single person saying that was a good life. That was a faithful life. I want that to be my story so badly. So how do we do it? How do we do it? I like how Robert Robinson wrote in the hymn, Come the Fount of Every Blessing. He was only 22 when he wrote this, but I think it's a beautiful example. He says, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. Maybe the beginning point is to say, yeah, left unchecked, we can kind of make a mess of things. Left unchecked, we can actually go on that well-worn path that is not a path that leads to where I want to end up. But there's also this well-known phrase, youth is wasted on the young and wisdom is wasted on the old. And anyone stop to wonder, like, well, if that's true, like, why are we wasting wisdom? Like, why not, like, take advantage of wisdom? Why not go to school? Why not actually see wisdom as something to pursue? Why not actually look at the lives of those that have finished well or didn't finish well and stop long enough to listen to individuals at that stage in life and say, what are your joys? What are your regrets? And if you have someone in your life that is in that stage, what are you doing to intentionally listen and say, tell me your story? What are the joys? Are there any regrets? What advice would you have for me? Let's learn from the hard-earned wisdom of those that have gone before us. And I also think we can go to school on one of the oldest and wisest individuals that we have. Who is known as the wisest individual that we have? Solomon. Yeah. I heard a couple other names. I'm going with Solomon on that. And Solomon, what is it about King Solomon? What is it? We know the story. God appears to him and he says, what shall I give you? Isn't that an incredible question? Just put yourself in Solomon's situation. He is asked by God for his wish list. Anything you want, Solomon. But Solomon knows. He knows what matters. And I love this. But it says this. It says, Solomon said, give your servant an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? Isn't that a posture of incredible humility that Solomon had at this point in his life? He realized, this task, God, that you've given me, it's beyond my ability. It's beyond my ability to lead well. He was young when he was appointed. His mom is Bathsheba. His dad is David. He is appointed in this role, and he knows there's a lot of other people that were vying for this same role of king following David. And David says, no, it's going to be Solomon. And Solomon enters in knowing, I do not know how to do this job. There is a beautiful humility in this moment. But God says this. He says, I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never be anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both wealth and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And then you read the story of Solomon, and God did give him all of that. He had incredible wisdom, great insight. And I love this. In 1 Kings chapter 4, it gives a little bit of context, which I find a little bit of like not humble bragging in this. But it says, Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the people of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else, including Ethan the Ezrahite. Wouldn't you hate to be Ethan for all time, to be known as like, you're number two on that. Wiser than He-Man, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. Like, they're listing the individuals. You think they're smart? No. King Solomon was in a class all of his own. This is wisdom. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. Take that, Taylor Swift. Like, literally 1,005. And that doesn't include the ones that he remade and released again on that. So he is having this incredible way. He is a poet. He's a leader. He's a military leader. And he is incredibly wise. The whole world sought audience with Solomon. Who's the most famous person to come and visit? Queen of Sheba. She comes and she brings her entourage. And she is impressed with what she saw. Exceeded the reputation on that. He accumulated chariots and horses. He's a brilliant strategist. He figures out the trade routes. He ends up controlling the trade routes. He also understands the importance of alliance. Who did he marry? His first wife? Yeah, Pharaoh's daughter, exactly. Marries Pharaoh's daughter, has an alliance with Egypt. And then he continues to go on military. There was no one like him in wisdom or in wealth. He ends up building the temple, something that his father David was not allowed to do. He is a global leader. He is respected. People come to him from all nations. He had it all. And how did his story end? It's the well-worn path. It wasn't his wife when he died throwing herself on him because he had 1,000 wives, and that like would be problematic on that. So like he had all kinds of things, and yet he lost his way. with all of his wisdom. But I think then the fascinating thing is one of the books of the Bible that I found so, so interesting, and we don't know if it is written by Solomon, I tend to believe it is, or someone writing as if they are King Solomon. It's just simply referred to as Koheleth, the teacher. But in this book of Ecclesiastes, we have an opportunity to look from the perspective of someone who has achieved every single thing and then say, did it really work? Did it really matter? And it starts out, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. What is his conclusion about all of his success, all that he has accomplished in his life? Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? What is he doing? He's on his deathbed and he's looking back at all that he labored, all that he toiled. And he's saying, at the end of it all, it is nothing. And then throughout the book, it is basically a crazy experiment where he stares at the sun and describes how badly it hurts. He literally looks at all of his accomplishments and his conclusion again, a refrain again and again. It is all meaningless. But a really important thing in the book of Ecclesiastes that we have to understand to get the essence is his experiment has parameters. The experiment of his parameters, he literally uses this phrase 29 times of under the sun. He is doing this experiment. He is saying under the sun. And what's another way of saying under the sun? Let's assume that we take God out of the equation. Let's assume that life at the best is a deist form. There is no personal relationship with a creator. And now let's look at life. And as he looks at life, taking a relationship with his creator out of it, his conclusion again and again is meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. And he looks at work. He looks at relationships and pleasure and satisfaction and wealth and influence and mortality and justice and knowledge and power. He looks at all of these areas. And I would say if you and I have the courage and bravery to do the same thing, we would come to the same conclusion. You take God out of this life and we are left with an utterly desperate nihilistic picture, a big zero. But here's the reality. We don't have to live life like that. We don't have to live life with an under-the-sun mentality. Under the sun, the conclusion is havel. That's the word. It's like mist. It's like a vapor. It's here, but there is no eternal significance. There is no ultimate meaning or satisfaction. It is a mist. It is gone. But in that moment, the great genius of the book of Ecclesiastes and the great gift that Solomon gives us is an invitation that I believe he came to at the end of his life, is to say, but what if that wasn't the only way to live? What if there was not an under the sun, but what if there was an above the sun perspective? And that above the sun perspective would change everything. And you can go back to that list. You go back to the list. Let's look at work. Let's look at pleasure. Let's look at finances. Let's look at every single thing and let's look at it. Let's have the courage and bravery to say, take God out and what are we left with? Let's put God in and see what beautiful meaning there can be in that moment. That is the great experiment of Ecclesiastes. That is the gift. And I believe that that is the invitation for us at this moment of time. In these moments to say, God, if you are real, if you are who you say you are, if you really did rise from the grave, if you are alive, if you are empowering us with our Holy Spirit, well, that simply changes everything. The above the sun perspective literally changes every single thing. It changes everything if we believe that Jesus is who he said he is. It changes everything. It provides meaning and purpose in the day to day. And I love that. I was thinking about like which one do we go in? We dive into all kinds of different areas, but I just think about this gift of friendship. And I just want to go a little bit deeper on that because it's one of the interesting things that Solomon raises for us, just as one case study of his conclusion of the difference of an above the sun and below the sun perspective. But his life was lived below the sun. And the interesting thing is below the sun, he had no real relationships. When he says this, he says, pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. You know who he's talking about? He's talking about himself. He's talking about himself, and in old age, he probably had a very real situation of falling and not having any real friends. If two lie down together, they will keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. If you look at the difference between the life of David and Solomon, one of the interesting things is Solomon had no friends. He had a lot of subjects. He had a lot of conscripted labor. He had a lot of people that did what he told them to do, but he had no real friendships. And contrast that to David. David, in his moment where he had his own incredible, foolhardy moments, he had friends show up and call him on it. David journeyed with friends. He had Jonathan as his deep soul friend. Nathan, after all that he did with Bathsheba and the murder and of Uriah, and then he has Nathan actually show up and rebuke him. And then he has Joab when David wanted to do the census, and Joab's like, that just sounds like an exercise in pride. I don't think you should do it. He had individuals that we see showing up in his life, and yet we look at Solomon. There is never a recorded confrontation or situation in a mutual relationship. Solomon lived his life with ultimate success, but he was lonely. I find that so interesting because today, every stat that I'm looking at say that we are living in an age of Solomon, not of David. We are living in a time where those types of real friendships of individuals that do life together, they are increasingly rare. And it's on the rise as well. And in this moment, as we read in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, you almost hear him. He's like, don't follow my path. My path of success without relationship is not a path that you want to go. Invite others into the journey with you. That is where you find meaning and satisfaction. That is the moment. And it's so easy today to follow the path of Solomon of pleasure, as opposed to the more difficult work of relationship that we're invited into. Pleasure separates, it isolates, it does not invite us into real relationship. I like how Basil Pennington writes this, says this. He says, we're broken persons and live in broken communities in a state of brokenness. I mean, that's pretty cheerful on that. But I love this next line. He says, we do not readily fit together. We're like a bunch of porcupines trying to huddle together for warmth. We're always driven apart out of the fear we can inflict on each other with our quills. We're like porcupines. We know we need the warmth, but we keep poking each other. But an above-the-sun perspective says there is going to be grace, there is going to be so much forgiveness, and there is going to be a deep commitment to the other, independent of how it costs me. I am going to love even when it costs. And that invites relationships. That invites us. Friendship is just one really simple way of looking at this. And I love, I was living in Rwanda, and a friend of mine, Pierre Bizimana, said this. He said, in the rural communities, he said, we know we need four friends. He said, in the U.S., I don't think you need four friends. It's like, why four? Very precise number. It's like, well, that's how many people it takes to carry the stretcher at 3 a.m. if you need someone. He's like, we know who our people are. We know who our friends are. And it might not be a physical stretcher, but I know the times in my life where I have needed someone to show up with a casserole and a hug on that. I know those moments in my life. And so in this work that we get to do, I just find it so interesting that we are wired for community. And yeah, it's going to be more difficult. Yes, it's going to require a whole lot more grace. But an above-the-sun perspective, inviting God in, means we're willing to do the difficult work of journeying together. And that is just one little example we see again and again in the book of Ecclesiastes. But the conclusion is this. Life under the sun, that is not reality. It is possible to invite God in. It is possible to live life with a perspective that says, because of Jesus, there is meaning, there is purpose, and I am not alone in this journey. And so the wonderful teacher, Koheleth, concludes his book, he concludes his memoir with these words that I think are good for all of us. Now, all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. And I think when we do that, when we fear God and we keep His commandments, and we do it doing life with others, I think we are far more likely to have a story that ends in a hospital room surrounded by loved ones and everyone there saying that was a life well lived.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.